Good afternoon, family. My name's Linda, and I'm a great member of Al-Anon. I have to tell you right now, with these women up here, I am more comfortable than I've been since I came into the city limits. I like the opening of our meetings. It makes me feel at home, and it did from the first time. So I really appreciate you being here with me. It means a great deal. Thank you. I enjoyed Suzanne very much and the reading. And I'm anxious. You know, I have never performed on a Nevada stage before, although I have a little bit of performance in my history, as you'll hear about. So I'm going to do what Al-Anon has taught me to do, and that's to ask for what I need. Just as we had the moment of silence before the Serenity Prayer, somebody asked Lois Wilson one time, who was the co-founder of Al-Anon. She was married to Bill, as we know. Somebody asked her what she did in the moment of silence, and she said, "I invite God to the meeting." So if we could have another moment of silence, and if you'd be willing to ask the God of your understanding to come and be here. I've already had a lengthy conversation with the God of my understanding, like, "How come you got me here?" And gave thanks for that, actually. So if we'd have a moment of silence, and if you'd be willing to invite your God to come be with us. I'm going to need it. And as I've learned from my husband, you can also ask your God and ask yourself not to judge the speaker if you'd like to use the moment of silence for that. So please, a moment of silence. Thank you. So I'm not up here by myself. I've got the wonderful God of my understanding. I've got the support of my sponsor and my home group. In fact, they gave me this safety pin. It's a big one because I had to come a long distance to be with you guys. It's just an everyday safety pin because in my group, that's how we help one another. It's kind of the low-budget version of a guardian angel. And any time we're going to do something scary, like give a talk or visit parents, you know, they give us a safety pin. So I know I have the group here with me. I have my sponsor support and cheering me on. She reminds me of my manners. I want to thank the committee for inviting me. I'd like to thank all the committees for 21 conferences. That's a big time for throwing a party. You finally came of age, right? I want to say that my instructions were to fly into Las Vegas, rent a car, and start driving across to Laughlin, Nevada. Now, I did that. I got in by 1:30. I rented a great car. It was a really fun car, fancy car, some kind of strange car. It looked like a UFO to me. And I had a good time climbing into it and traveling and finding my way down here. And I kept looking at the map because there weren't a lot of road signs once I got on the road. And it's like every time I looked at the map, somehow it was going to make me be where I was supposed to be. I don't know, but every time I'd look at Laughlin, I thought it said Laugh-In. And I thought, okay, we're coming to Laugh-In. I can handle that. That's what conferences are like. And I love driving across the desert because it looks like this wonderful area may have been an ocean and God made sandcastles all around us. So I really had a great feeling of coming in and coming into the valley here and then being by the water. Is it not incredible to have this high desert and have that water coming through? I mean, it's just our lives are remarkable. In fact, I have in my life what I call quality whining now. I was talking to one of the Al-Anons in the elevator. Some of our best meetings happen in elevators at conferences. And she said she had helped with the T-shirts, and they were having quality whining because they ran out of black T-shirts and the gray T-shirts didn't have pockets on them. And I thought, isn't that amazing that this is what we have to complain about? You know, that's pretty incredible. I do like going to conferences. I am looking forward to going to Toronto when we get to have that big birthday party, the celebration of AA International. Hope to see you there. Yeah. And the first time I got to go and see this incredible 12-step AA Al-Anon that we come here to celebrate and speak the language of the heart, the first time I got to participate in an international was in San Diego. I had qualified. I could have gone to Seattle. I'd been in Al-Anon, but that situation didn't work out. So I get to go to San Diego, And I want to tell you what that trip looked like, because what conferences look like, why we come together. You know, it's like we may have given up the drink, but we're not giving up the party. So we have these roundups and get-togethers. So my wonderful now and forever husband, Scott, who you'll get to hear in the morning, and also you'll get to hear at the relationship workshop at 10 o'clock tonight. We're always a little cautious about doing relationship workshops because every time we have on our schedule, we usually have a really big spat right before it happens. So it's the countdown between now and 10 o'clock to see. We've been getting along great, husband. Thank you. So Scott and I are in Nashville, Tennessee, and we're going to go out to San Diego to the big AA birthday party, which I think was, what, 10 years ago? Yeah, 10 years ago. And we show up at the airport, and we run into some people that we knew from meetings. So that makes sense. They're going to go out there to San Diego also. And that plane we got on landed in St. Louis, Missouri, and some of the earthlings got off, and some more of us got on. You could tell because we had on the jewelry with the circles and the triangles on it. So that was a really big, huge jet, and we're on our way to San Diego, and it's really a big jet, and it's really feisty, and it's packed out, and we seem to be having a good time because we're going on a holiday. And I'm at the back of the airplane, and I start chatting with the flight attendant, and I say, "Are you having a good day?" Because she's working. You know, I'm here to play and have a good time, but I said, "Are you having a good day?" She says, "Yes, we're very, very busy. Every single seat is taken, and we have never served so much coffee." Yep, that's us, right? So we get out to San Diego, and I was invited to be on one of the panels, not share my story like I'm doing now, but I had a pre-assignment like months ahead of time. And my topic was to share about 15 minutes on living with sobriety after the honeymoon's over. Since I'm in my third marriage, I thought maybe they wanted to know about how to have a really neat honeymoon, you know? And I tell you, I did my part. I studied around that topic. I read our wonderful, The Dilemmas of the Alcoholic Marriage, Sex and Intimacy, that little pamphlet that's got some great sharing. No pictures, but some great sharing in it. And I read all of our readings around this topic. And I really recommend that Dilemmas of the Alcoholic Marriage, no matter what program you're in, whether you're in a relationship or not. It's got some great, great information there. And it boils it down to one word, and that's the word courtesy. That's a pretty neat way to do any relationship. So I think I shared pretty well on what I had to say for my 15 minutes, but I cannot tell you one single thing I had to say, because the woman that spoke before me, when she introduced herself, she told my entire Al-Anon story, just in the way she said hello. And from that point on, I was kind of thinking about that. I thought, I've been going to these meetings all this time. This is exactly what's been going on in my life. I've been working these steps to find it out, and now she put it in one sentence. She said this, "Hi, my name is so-and-so, and I'm from Georgia. I'm a member of Al-Anon, and I'm addicted to mood-altering men." Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. And that is my story. You know, and thanks to Al-Anon, I don't have to apologize for it. And thanks to my wonderful husband, he wants to take it a step further. He says, "I'm so good at this antennae that I have, that when we're going off to an AA conference, most of the time we've just talked to the AA member on the telephone, and we've never laid eyes on him." And he said, "Look, I'll go get the luggage, and you go pick them out." Because I can do it in a busy airport. It doesn't matter. Don't matter how many are there. Man, I can just zero right in on them. And I'm so good at it that for my birthday several years ago, Scott gave me about 500 business cards. True story. He said, "I'm always trying to help recovery in our wonderful community of Nashville, Tennessee." And he said, "You can use these business cards." He said, "If you're at the grocery store or you're at the dry cleaners and you look over there and you see somebody you're real attracted to," he said, "you can hand them one of these business cards." I said, "Okay." The front of them has my name, a couple of butterflies, phone number, that sort of thing. Very appropriate. The back side says this, "Hi, my name is Linda. I am a member of Al-Anon. I find you attractive, so I suggest you go to the nearest treatment center and have an assessment done. True? He said, just think how much time that would save, you know? And it is the truth. I mean, I'm going through these hallways, and my little heart's just going thumpity-thump. All of these wonderful speakers that we've had, all of these wonderful people on committee, and I don't have to apologize for it. I tell you, the first person I could probably hand this card to, the first guy that actually took my heart away is my dad. Now, I've known my dad all my life, and I've seen my dad drink almost every day of my life. I've seen him drunk. And quite honestly, my dad would have a great time here because he told me about 6 months ago, he's in his early 80s, and he says, I'm going to do three things for the rest of my life. And I thought, oh, okay, this is our very first dad and daughter conversation. This is going to get interesting. And he listed the three things he was going to do for the rest of his life, and he listed them like sporting events. He says, I'm going to fish. That's great. We have a boat. We're right across from the lake. He says, I'm going to play golf. He just shot 78 the other day. This is great. And he says, and I'm going to drink. And thanks to Al-Anon, I could say, thank you for sharing that with me. Now, I grew up in West Texas, pre-desert, kind of like this, but actually not as, it's a lot more flat. It's like totally flat. I say it makes people honest because you cannot sneak up on anybody. You can see them coming a long way away. And I'm an only child. And my parents absolutely loved and adored me. They still do. They still call me in even business situations. My dad still calls me by the pet name, Pumpkin. And my mother still calls me Angel Girl. And I grew up in a household that my parents came from having nothing, including indoor plumbing and no electricity. And in one marriage, one generation, they turned all of that around. And they wanted to give me the stuff. They wanted to give me my own room. They wanted to give me my own car. They wanted to give me all the back seat when we went on a family vacation. Nobody looked out my window. And it was a great, great life. I mean, everybody could have said, how great, because all of the money that had to go for shoes and clothes didn't have to be divided between brothers and sisters. I got it all. And they kept me happy and busy and dressed and showed off. And my dad continued to drink, and my mom continued to argue with my dad about his drinking. I never heard them argue about anything except my dad's drinking. And I couldn't have told you that that was causing any problems in my family, in that household growing up, any more than I could have said, man, eating macaroni and cheese is really wrecking this family. Because it was so much a daily way of life. My dad was a successful businessman. He entertained customers. We traveled all over. In fact, my first trip to Nevada was in 1956 when the New Frontier was opened. I got to see Elvis as the warm-up act. And my parents came and played, and they had a very feisty life. And they've been doing that dance for a long time. And I didn't know that anything was going on in that household that might be causing problems because we look like such a happy family. And then I got into Al-Anon, and I got my hands on some of the Alateen literature. You know the little pop quiz that we have? 20 questions. You take this as an adult, and maybe you can figure out why you did not do so well on that math test in the 7th grade. Because when you were at school, you were wondering what was going on at home. And when you were at home, you were trying to get out of there as fast as you could. Listen to some of the questions. It says, has your life been affected by someone else's drinking? Alateen is for you, exclamation point. So as an adult, I look back and it says, number one, do you believe no one could possibly understand how you feel? Two, do you cover up for your real feelings by pretending you don't care? Do you stay out of the house as much as possible because you hate it there? Are you afraid or embarrassed to bring friends home? Are holidays often interrupted? Are meals disturbed? Oh, I see. I qualified for Alateen. I am not the first flower to bloom in this garden. That's what was going on in that household. But because my parents had a very feisty, successful life, I didn't think anything was going on in that household. But I think I started working on what I call step zero. You know that hollowness in your gut that nothing can fill. No mood-altering men, no fancy dress, no getting invited to the prom. Nothing could fill it up. Nothing. And I tried. Straight hair, I permed it, you know, whatever. I tried a lot of things to be happy. And I tried a lot of things to make the other people happy around me. Because I thought if they were happy, then I would be happy too. Wasn't that I was trying to control, I just wanted everybody to be happy. And I was like the net at a tennis match between my parents. And I didn't know I wanted to get out of that household. I graduated from high school in 1964. For those of you that are way back there, I'm really old. I turned 60 this year, and I'm so excited about that, my 60s. It's incredible that Al-Anon has given me a life back to look forward to. In fact, I often say, this is the future we used to be so afraid of. I mean, sitting right here with other people, laughing and having a good time, this is the future I used to be so frightened of. So, 1964, getting out of high school, I decided to stay at home and go to college at a local college because I didn't know how to leave my parents. I thought they needed that adult supervision that came from the child rather than from the parent. But I'm at this campus, and I see this young man, and I could have given him one of these business cards because my heart went pitter-patter, and evidently something in him went pitter-patter because he had known me for 2 weeks when he asked me to marry him. I thought, that was great. We went to tell my parents, we're so excited, we want to get married. And they started asking really bothersome questions like, don't you think he should have a job first? And we're going, oh, that's just details, we'll work it out. And so, quite honestly, I'd been a good girl for about as long as I could be. And being a good girl in the early 60s was pretty important to me, the way I was raised. And so my parents gave us a wonderful storybook wedding. I wore the white gown, the long veil. I marched down the center of the church, and our friends were there. And I deserved to have this wonderful wedding, wearing that white dress, and my husband and I get married. I just turned 20 years old, and we lived happily ever after for the first week. And then to celebrate our being married for 1 week, my husband, we were still college students, my husband brought home two of his best friends into our small apartment. It was Cliff, who was probably in his history class, and Bud, that came in the cooler in between them. And to celebrate our being married for 1 week, my husband and his best friend decided to have a party. And I saw him drink, and I saw him laugh, and I saw him have a pretty good time, and I saw him go to sleep or pass out. The friend was on the couch. My husband was on our bed. Our apartment was about the size of this stage. And I took the stance. You might recognize it. Pre-Al-Anon stance, hands on hip, tapping my toe, looking around at these two guys like a lot of fallen trees, and I'm thinking, I'm not going to let him get away with this. I'm going to show him he cannot get drunk to celebrate our being married for 1 week. So that night, to show my husband, I was always one of the pre-Al-Anons that had a plan. I always had a plan. That night, I had a great plan, and to show him he couldn't drink like that and pass out on our bed and to punish him that night, I slept in the bathtub. Seemed like a good idea at the time, you know. And so the next morning, he's got a hangover. I've got a backache. And that was the dance that we did for 16 years and two lovely daughters. He would always go out and party, and I'd always make him pay for it some way. Now, this young man that couldn't find a job, we kept being college students and moving around, and we'd been married about 3 years when our first daughter was born. And I thought when you brought home the baby, you brought home the agreement that now you would grow up and you'd act like adults. I thought that's what the fine print said. You're now parents and you'll now be adults. You'll get a job. You'll have a picket fence. We've heard that story. We're now going to live happily ever after. But he was still having a little problem finding himself. And then one day he accidentally got a job. He was hanging out his favorite saloon, his favorite bar, which was in a Holiday Inn. And this is back in Texas when they had the private clubs. It was before liquor by the drink. And you would have to be a membership of a private club. So every Ramada, every Sheraton, every Holiday Inn had a lounge act. And that was to lure people into coming in for cocktail hour, and then the music would start and you'd stay longer and longer and longer. Music then was never about making music. It was about selling alcohol. So he's there drinking in his favorite club, and they say, we need to have somebody to get up and sing. He was very good with the guitar, and he had a great voice. He ran home, got it, ran back, auditioned. All of a sudden, he's making more money in 1 week than we'd seen in months. And he also now has a career. He's in the music industry. And that Holiday Inn asked him to go to their other Holiday Inn about 30 miles away. And that Holiday Inn asked him to go to another Holiday Inn about 50 miles away. And all of a sudden, he is touring all over Texas. Now, I am the mom with the young baby, and I thought I was supposed to stand by my man. So I threw what limited possessions we had into a storage. I packed up the baby, the diapers, the hot plate. I got everybody a big trunk, and you put everything you wanted to have in that. And I started following him like a camp follower from hotel to hotel with this baby. And now I'm living without an address. I'm living upstairs in a hotel room with a small child. And I'm seeing my husband go down to work every night because it was work. He got paid for it. And he would come home from work, and it would kind of seem like he'd been to a party because he'd smell like he'd been to a party and he'd act like he'd been to a party. So I thought, I'm pretty bored up here with this baby by myself night after night. I don't know anybody in these towns, and I want my husband to be happy, and he'd been very unhappy about the people in the band. So one Friday afternoon, I went to him and I said, I've got a great plan. He said, what is it? And I said, well, I'm going to be the drummer in the band. He said, have you ever played drums before? And I said, that's just details. We'll work it out. So I took the bass player with me to a pawn shop on Saturday, and for $50, I'm telling you, I bought a whole trap set of drums. The bass drum, the two ride toms, the floor tom, the hi-hat, the snare drum, the crash cymbal. Monday night, I was the drummer in the band. You can't tell me we're not determined people. You know, I thought I needed to be there by him because that particular week he had five different drummers. And at least if I might not be a good drummer, but at least I'd show up. And that began our career in the music industry. And now we're getting very successful in Texas, and we're getting a lot of limelight, and it's always in the telling. We would come into a town, and there our name would be up on the marquee. Never mind that I wouldn't have a babysitter, and I'm going to have to leave my daughter with somebody I don't even know their names, because the innkeeper would have to get a babysitter for us. That was in the contract. And we became so well known that no matter who was playing in the area, we were known as the After Hours Club. You might remember those. That's when the law said you could no longer serve alcohol, but we would lock the door and we would continue to make music all night long. The sitter was a high school girl, and she'd eventually have to go home. And I thought I was a really, really good mom, because I would go upstairs to that hotel room and I'd take the phone off the hook and I'd put it beside my daughter. And then I'd go back downstairs and I'd take the phone off the hook in the bar. And then I would be with my husband and his musician friends, and we would make music all night long. And many, many times I've seen the sun come up, and I'd take breaks and I'd go over and I'd see if that baby was awake, that youngster was awake. And I thought I was a really, really good wife and good mom, because I was trying to be two places at one time. Now, I became very successful playing the drums. You do anything night after night. And I realized that I was also looking out there and trying to control everybody's drinking, really, back then, because I would work out with the cocktail waitresses. I've noticed that when the band takes a break, a lot of times people leave. But if you make sure everybody has a full drink on the table, we take our 15-minute break, they'll drink that drink, and then they'll still be here, then we'll start making more music. I mean, I really took this on like a business, to control people's drinking. And we were very successful, and then our second daughters, there's 8 years between my girls, my second daughter came along, and we had moved, and we had lived without addresses, and I decided with that second daughter that I needed to get out of the music industry. And my husband had said, well, let's go to Nashville. And I thought that would be the last of the moves. In 16 years of marriage, we moved 13 times. That doesn't even count the times that we did not have an address. And I thought that made a lot of sadness and a lot of drama around geographic cures. But if you look at our history books, Lois and Bill Wilson had 52 different mailing addresses. We desperately try to outrun this disease. And what would happen is I'd pack up the books, I'd pack up the baby's toys, I'd pack up the dishes, and I'd pack up the disease, and I'd move it on down the road. Now, this young man that stood in front of me, and he would say, I think it would be better if we moved to Dallas. He wasn't trying to set me up. He really thought it would be better, and I really believed him. And he'd say, I think it'll be better if we move to Houston. He wasn't trying to set me up. We were just trying to outrun the disease. And we always thought we were moving toward the dream. So we ended up in Nashville, Tennessee. He'd been very successful back in Texas. The success didn't come fast enough for him in Nashville. And sometimes the party becomes more important than taking care of business. And the music industry in Nashville is serious business. So he came in and announced that he, to get packed, we were moving back to Texas. And quite honestly, I was so old and so used up and so worn out, I couldn't. And he used the trump card on me. He said, well, I guess we just divorce. And at that point in time, I had no energy left to fight or to argue. And I said, I guess we do. So the man that lived next door was an attorney for $50. He handled our divorce. My then husband packed up all of his music instruments into his car. He drove away back to Texas. And I wish him the best. He's raising another family, and I keep him in my prayers because he's the natural father of my girls. The happier he is, the better every single exchange my adult children will have with their natural dad. Meanwhile, my story is we're the family left in the rearview mirror. Here's the mom, whose resume says drummer in the band. Here's the pre-teenage daughter, and here's a 3-year-old. And we're looking, and we're waving goodbye. And the man that handled my divorce said, there's a guy that's got a commercial real estate company on the 25th floor of the First American Center. I think you're going to need a better paying job, or you're going to need a job. You better go talk to him. So I went down and talked to him, and he asked me to be his manager of his office. I didn't know my control skills could be put over into business, that I could manage. I could manage an office. I could manage shopping centers. I could manage a day planner. I could manage things. And I took to that, and it took to me. And now I'm convinced that we're going to live happily ever after because Mom is making a lot of money. I got my broker's license as fast as I could, and I'm now developing shopping centers. And we're going to live happily ever after because I am managing to keep a lot of money in the bank. And I have to tell you that I ignored my 2 girls the same way anybody would with a drug or a drink. My message I would give them was, you just get yourself off to school because I've got a power networking breakfast I've got to get to this morning. And I'd send my daughter off to school on her own. And then I'd call them in the evening and I'd say, you just stick something in the microwave because I've got some very important people in town. And I need to take them out to dinner. So the message I kept giving those girls were that there's other things out there more important than you. And I expect you to grow up on yourself, by yourself, on your own. So I'm making a lot of money and I'm very successful. And it looks like I'm getting a lot of strokes from society and from my parents. Because keeping score with money, you get a lot of strokes. But one Christmas, we get the photos back and I look at the mom, I look at the oldest daughter, I look at the little daughter, and we don't look happy. I look at that photo and I'm thinking, what's missing from this picture? A man. I'm now in my mid-30s. I don't think I have a lot of time, so I marry my boss. Now, when I went to work for him, he kept asking me out, but he was married to someone else at the time. And he kept saying, that's just details. We'll work it out, you know. So here's the Cinderella story. This very successful businessman, because I'm not marrying any more musicians, I'm going to marry a businessman. This very successful businessman marries his very successful secretary, adopts her 2 children, moves us into a mansion. I can tell you it was a mansion. It was right across from the governor's mansion there in Nashville, and it had 6 bathrooms. Believe me, that's a mansion. And this looks like a Cinderella story because now we're going to live happily ever after. My girls are in private schools. We have 6 sailboats. We're traveling all over the world. We've got all the new cars. And I am married to a businessman, and I'm conducting myself in business, and we're making lots of money, and we're in all of the perfect organizations, like the 100-year-old Cognac Club. That was so important. And Friends of the Wine. I mean, we had a wine cellar that would rival a small restaurant. So we're now going to live happily ever after. But We didn't. Some strange things started happening in that house. They started happening right away, and I took that man kicking and screaming into marriage counseling because I didn't think a second failed marriage would look good on my resume. And I'd pick this doctor out of the phone book, and I'd take my husband in after we'd have some kind of horrible fight, not knowing even what we were fighting about. It's pretty hard to keep fighting and not even know what you're fighting about. So I'd take him into this counselor, and I would tear up, and I would weep, and I would cry. And my then husband would totally shut down. He would fold his arms over his chest and almost doze off. And I think the good doctor almost dozed off too, because eventually he would pick up a paper clip and he would undo it and he'd get it just right and he'd kind of twirl it around and would all kind of be looking at it. And then he'd see his watch and he'd say, "Oh, we're out of time." And he'd tell me, "You're too sensitive." And he'd tell my husband, "You're not sensitive enough. Go away." And, you know, that'll be $150. $200, whatever it was. So every time we'd have a fight, we'd go see this doctor. And we had lots of fights. And they were very, very, they were bad fights. And we were working together, and we're trying to raise these girls together. And I'm confused as why we're not living happily ever after. And so to cure all these fights, sometimes we'd go on little holidays. And we'd go on holidays down to we'd go to Venezuela. We'd just pick some place, and we'd just travel like we're going to still outrun the disease. We have the same address, but we're desperately still trying to outrun the disease. So we're in one of these little holidays with my husband and his best friend and his best friend's girlfriend. I guess the wife wasn't supposed to come on that particular holiday. So we're down at the Lower Florida Keys with this other couple, and we're at dinner. We had a road trip that day. Road trip with a capital R. You might remember some of those. And I was absolutely exhausted. I just finished a big business deal, and we were in a nice restaurant. I remember because it had tablecloths on it. And when you're in Florida in the Lower Florida Keys and they have tablecloths, you know you're not at the Lean-To Crab Shack, which are great places to eat. But we were at a very nice restaurant. And I said something wrong. I said, "Pass the salt, please." Or I said, "Please pass the salt." But whatever it was wrong. And I saw what I now know is the monster of the disease show up in my husband's face. And there's going to be a scene, and it's going to be public, and it's going to be awful because I've been through these before. And something in me snapped, and I started my run. I didn't know I was on a run, but I'm desperately trying to outrun the disease. And I stood up, and I said, "I'm going home." And they thought that meant I was going back to the hotel. But something inside me had snapped, and I said, "I'm going home." And I started trying to get back to Nashville, Tennessee from the Lower Florida Keys. I had to call for a cab because I'm there with them in a rental car. And I walked out of that restaurant, and this little cab driver, I called on phone, and I said, "Take me to the Miami airport." Well, you know, that's over like 170 miles away, and he's trying to tell me this cab won't make it, and I'm going, whatever, you know. And I'm a pretty sophisticated businesswoman, but I'd never been home with a cab driver before. And about the time I should be cautious about this, we pull up in this cab driver's driveway. His wife opens the door, and she says, "Honey, you come on in here and wait." He said he can't take that cab down to the airport, but he'll get that big van ready, and he'll take you to the airport. And I'm so upset of walking out that I say, "Okay, whatever." And I go into this woman's house, this cab driver and his wife, and I stop at the door. I can see their entire house. She's cooking some kind of wonderful soup back there on the stove. There's not even a division. The kitchen's just on the back wall. And there's a bathroom right here, and their bed was just kind of over here on the side. And she's folding clothes there on the couch. And I stop, and I thought, wow. This feels like a home. And I'm going back to a house that has 6 bathrooms. And she said, "Look like you're having a really rough time. Can I do something to help?" She was one of those guardian angels that come into our lives and we're not even aware of it. And I said, "Well, I'd like to buy a pair of those cotton socks because I'm in a sundress and have on sandals. And I know that I'm going back to Nashville, Tennessee. And I'd left some, it was in February, and I'd left some pretty severe weather. In fact, we'd had snow, a big snow blizzard. And I knew I was going back to that. And I'd walked out without anything." And she says, "Honey, I'll just give you these socks." You think that's not a guardian angel? They can come in any kind of description. So she gave me these socks. She trusted me with her husband. They were good business people. They made me pay them in cash because I am a distraught woman at this time. And I go back to the Miami airport, and There are no flights. You know, by this time it's 1 o'clock in the morning or so. There were no flights out anywhere. And I was in a part of the Miami airport. I don't think this is true now, but at that particular time it was under construction. And it was open to the street. And I could not find a room because there was a sailboat show going on and some kind of automobile race going on. And believe me, I am sophisticated. I can take care of myself. So my only choice is to spend the night in the Miami airport. Well, where I was not a safe place. It was kind of locked away from the rest, and it was open to the outside city. And here this very sophisticated businesswoman that's got a lot of money in the bank that has a house that's very big across the street from the governor's mansion. I was like a bag lady on the street. I spent the entire night just trying to stay safe. And I said a prayer, and I hadn't prayed probably since the now I lay me down to sleep, because you see, I'm tough and I can take care of myself and I can pull off big business deals. And I hadn't said a prayer of any kind for a long, long time. And with my back up against the wall, trying to stay safe, that particular night I said, God, my life is unmanageable. That was a prayer. I managed shopping centers. I managed to keep two secretaries busy all the time. My girls are in private lessons. They have their own day planners. My cat and dog practically had their own day planners, but when they're going to go to the vet, you better believe I managed. So for me to use the word, my life is unmanageable, was a very strange word. So I finally get on a plane, and I get back to Nashville, Tennessee, and I did what my mom taught me to do. I went to that very big house, and I waited. I didn't wait in my bedroom because it wasn't safe. My oldest daughter is off at college. My young daughter is at the babysitter's, and I went to that young daughter's room because that's how old I felt. I climbed up against the stuffed animals and the pink doll things, and I waited. I waited for him to come home, and boy, was he angry. I had seen that man angry before. He was my second husband. I was his fourth wife. And he says, no woman has ever walked out on me before. And now there's going to be a scene and it's going to be ugly. And I had that moment of truth. I said, why don't we call the doctor before we have the fight? And this is a doctor you used to have to call and 6 weeks ahead of time have an appointment. Remember the one that twirled the paperclip? Because I was so organized, the number was right there. I called and the lady said, if you can be here within 15 minutes, the doctor can see you. And so we got in our car, and we did the 15-minute drive that was absolutely terrifying. We know what anger sounds like. It sounds like a plate of food thrown up against the wall. It sounds like a lamp crashing to the floor. Anger sounds like skin hitting skin. But the silent anger in that car going to the doctor's office that day was absolutely frightening. How we both survived that 15-minute drive, I'll never know. So we go into this doctor's office, and this time, he greets us. And he tells me to sit down, and he tells my husband to sit down, and he gets around on his side of the desk, and he leans forward, and he says, before you start talking, I need to say something. My name is Dr. So-and-so, and I am an alcoholic. And I need to make amends to my clients because I haven't always been as present as I should have been. From that time to the last time we'd seen him, the man had gotten into recovery and he was a changed person. His face looked different. His body looked different. And his words were very, very different. And he says, I know what's going on in your household because my household has been living it. It looks like the good life and that life is killing you. And my wife and I were going to go up to this week-long couples retreat, and we can't go. But I want to give you the tickets, and here's the schedule, and I want you to go up there, and they'll help you at this treatment center. So the next day, my husband and I are on a flight to South Dakota. I mean, I am hanging out at airports a lot in early recovery here. So we get to South Dakota, and this is the way we arrive at this treatment facility. My husband always says that an airplane was one of his favorite lounges. So that's the way we show up at the treatment center. And just to pass the time, I'm walking around the check-in room, and it was kind of a large room where they had the major meetings. And there were these two banners like we have on the wall here. And I look up, and there's that word unmanageable. And I thought, isn't that strange that would show up again in my thought process? Because remember, I manage. I manage shopping center. I manage other people's lives. I manage. And here's that word again. So for 1 week long, we're at this couples retreat. Let me tell you what it looks like. It looks like people holding hands walking around the lake. It looks like people holding hands going into dinner. It looks like Noah's Ark is what it looks like. And every time it was our turn to work on our marriage, they would take my husband into the other room. Now, how can we work on our relationship if they have him in the other room? What I know is Alcoholics Anonymous and Al-Anon is not about saving relationships. It's about saving lives. And they had that man in the other room knocking on his wall of denial into some of his activities. I can share with you now that not only was he an alcoholic, he was also a cocaine addict. He's also a cocaine entrepreneur. When you live in a nice address, that's what you call a drug dealer. And so they would have him in there trying to work on his situation, and I'm out there stomping my feet. How can we work on our marriage? And two things happen. I learned the Serenity Prayer, and as we were leaving that facility, the man that ran it gave me a hug, and he said, "Get yourself to Al-Anon." Now, we were in the Black Hills of South Dakota, and I decided Al-Anon was an Indian word. I had no idea of what it was. So we go back to Nashville, Tennessee to live happily ever after. But we had lost one of the valuable tools that we had living in that house, and that was the tool of denial. We no longer could not look at the elephant in the living room. We no longer could not look and walk around it. We had to do something about it. Things didn't get really good. There was no pink cloud. In fact, they got worse, as they sometimes do in early recovery. And weekends were long in my house then. I could always hide out at work, but I could not. Weekends were very long at this household. My oldest daughter was beginning her journey into drugs and alcohol. My 8-year-old daughter was her 8-year-old body had developed to like that of a young girl, and her moods and her hormones are bouncing around. And my husband is bottoming out on drugs and alcohol and other hobbies that would not help for an intimate marriage relationship. And the mom, the ones in charge, I have no spiritual connect. I have nothing but control, and you look at what your schedule is, and you read your script, and Neil will live happily ever after. And I'm absolutely falling apart. And it's a Monday, and I don't understand why I can't get my life together and their life together. And I remembered that, and I looked it up in the phone book. And this is what I tell when I go to any high school or to any, non-conference. When I go to a non-conference approved outing to talk about Al-Anon, I say, if you don't remember anything else, remember that it's in the phone book. Because there'll be a time when you're 8 years old or 42 or 72 that you may need it. And I'm so grateful that this woman answered the phone. And she said, there's a meeting about 2 blocks from your office. It just started about 2 months ago. She said, you get over there and they'll tell you. I could not ask her anything because I don't know what's going on in my own life. So I go over there, and that Monday meeting, downtown Al-Anon meeting, is still my home meeting today. Monday noon, 12 to 1, Nashville, Tennessee, Methodist Publishing House. I go into this meeting and I open up the door. And I go, what's that noise? And you said, that's laughter. Come on in. It had been a long time since I had heard any true laughter. Because you see, before I got into Al-Anon, I was trying to do something to the best of my ability, and I was trying to do it on a daily basis. And what I was trying to do is I was trying to please the disease. And you can't. The disease wants more. It is so greedy. It wants more and more and more. Now, I stood in that early Al-Anon meeting, and I took to it like some people would take to oxygen that hadn't had it for a very long time. And I did what I see newcomers do today. I did what I now call sing the hymns. You know the ones, him did this and him did that. And you let me stay, and you invited me to go to other meetings, and you gave me a schedule, and you gave me some of the literature. and you told me to get a sponsor, and you told me to start working the steps. Now, I got a sponsor who had 10 years marriage in recovery. I'm still trying to hang on to that second marriage. I think that if I can work my program big enough, long enough, strong enough, high enough, deep enough, it will change him. It was a first step problem. I can't work my program big enough, tall enough, deep enough, wide enough to change anyone but myself. My program is powerless over alcohol also. And that's what I had to learn. And it wasn't wrong for me to want some things out of a marriage relationship, but maybe it was wrong for me to demand them or want them from a man that wasn't in a place to give them. So that second marriage fell apart. We divorced. It took a very long time. It was like a business divorce. It took a very long time. We had a lot of business connect and a lot of property together, and it was very harsh. That's the only word I can use for it. It was very, very harsh. And if I hadn't had a sponsor that told me the truth, I wouldn't have been able to survive those days. I came home from a business meeting. The dog was at the dog sitter, and the kid was at the kid sitter, and my husband, soon-to-be ex-husband, was someplace where I didn't even know. We were forced to live in the same house for a year and a half while going through divorce. I lived upstairs, and he lived downstairs. It was a very difficult time. But I come home to this house, and it's dark, and I call my sponsor. She was a great sponsor for me because she told me the truth. I said, I just feel like I've been so rejected. And she said, you have been. And from hearing the truth, I realized that I could be able to speak some of my truths back. So I jumped into Al-Anon. I started doing what it says before our steps. It says, in Al-Anon, we strive for an ever deeper understanding for these steps and pray for the wisdom to apply them to our lives. So that's what my journey has been, applying these steps. And out of that, I've had three understandings. I've been able to find a God of my understanding. I've been able to find an incredible you of my understanding. And I've been able to find an incredible me, quite honestly, of my understanding. To explain that a little more clearly, the God of my understanding that I brought into you was like a referee at a sporting event. I'd be going along doing life, and a whistle would blow, and blam, I'm going to get penalized some way. That's the God I brought into you. The God of my understanding now, through the process of working the steps, is the one that follows in these steps. It was a power greater than myself. It was a God of my understanding. Then at the last of the steps, it was a God. And in the traditions, we get an adjective, a loving God. And that's been my journey into the God of my understanding, from a higher power to the God of my understanding to God to a loving God. But I have to tell you, this God is so great and so gentle, but also bigger than all the monsters under the bed. And that's the kind of God I needed. Now, I didn't get this God right away. I'd like to say that. But I kept watching your faces, and I kept having this thought of hope that there was this gentle God out there. But I just couldn't quite get it because I'd really had a punishing God that was keeping score and going to notice me if I acted up too much. And I'd already acted up a lot. I mean, I'd been single. I'd married early. I mean, I had been a feisty girl out there. My sponsor did not doze off in my fifth step, I'll put it that way. And so I didn't think God would be so interested in me anymore. And I didn't want God to get too interested in me. And so finally, I was able to get this God of my understanding from a bumper sticker. Not one of those easy does it or one day at a time. I love those bumper stickers because you can have a little meeting going down the interstate. I love those bumper stickers. This one was for a dog obedience school. And it said this. In tiny letters, it said Jones Dog Obedience School. In large letters, it said Sit Happens. And I got it. I could just sit. I could sit in meetings. I could sit in my backyard under a tree. I could sit out by the lake. I could sit by this wonderful river. And the presence of God was right there beside me, had never gone away, had always been there. And that's the gentle God that I needed to take me into that dark cave of steps 4 and 5. And I have a disease of amnesia. I forget that I have this gentle God. So to help me remember that I have this gentle God that I can rely on, I go back to an old TV commercial. It was for V8 juice. And the commercial, I think, was in black and white, and it shows people very busy in their life, and they're too busy to have lunch, and then all of a sudden they realize they haven't had lunch, and they hit their foreheads like this, and they go, oh, I could have had a V8. Well, when my life is absolutely falling apart, and I'm too busy being busy, and I'm too busy not connecting with God, and I'm too busy to turn to God, I go, oh, I could have had an HP. And so when I go on Monday, and this is very flat and red, they know where I am. So no matter how busy I am, I can always say I could have had an HP. And the other wonderful thing that helped me find this gentle God was my oldest daughter. This is a daughter that started finding her journey into drugs and alcohol when she was in high school. But I was too busy looking at him to notice what was going on with her. And I have to tell you that the most beautiful words this daughter ever said to me, they were not, I love you, Mom. They were, hi, Mom, my name's Jamie, and I'm an alcoholic. Because when she said those words to me, I knew there was hope, because I'd seen it in your faces and I'd heard it in your stories. And that daughter, last August, celebrated 15 years in AA. Incredible. Yes. That applause is for AA, because Alcoholics Anonymous parented her so wonderfully. Now, when she first got into AA and I first got into Al-Anon, I'd been in Al-Anon about 3 years when I couldn't understand why she didn't stop drinking. You know, the light bulb didn't go off in my own family. And finally, she did stop drinking, but she was young, sober, and college grad, still living at home, and playing cards every night with other young AA people. Now, they were living in an apartment upstairs of my house, and I'm thinking, isn't that wonderful? We all know where our kids are tonight. But these weren't kids. These were 21-year-old youngsters, young adults. And so one day she comes downstairs, and I hand her part of the light bill, her part of the water bill, her part of the phone bill, and I said, you know, she needed to find a job. I didn't say you need to find a job. I just said you need to pay your part of all of this. And she said, Mom, the day you treated me like an adult was the day I believed I could be one. How did I learn how to treat adults like adults? The little pamphlet, Detachment. You want to know how you're supposed to treat your adults in your life? You get a hold of this. This is core Al-Anon through and through. I think we need that with our children now. For the first time, I'm sponsoring some AA women, because some of their situations with their children are coming up, their adult children. I'm an adult child of God, and I expect the other adults to act like adults. And that's all. And they have to find their own spiritual journey. So when this daughter was in young AA and I was Al-Anon, we didn't get along too well. But finally some healing had happened. And one night she'd come over to eat. She'd moved out of the house, and we got ready to leave. And she said, Mom, would you like to pray with me? Well, I started hearing the Hallmark card music play in the background, you know. I'm thinking this is such a spiritual moment that my daughter's asked me to pray with her. And I must have had a funny look on my face, because I'm praying, God, please don't let me mess up this prayer with this daughter. And I had always thought it had to be very formal, that God's connect had to be very spiritual. And I very carefully get down on my hands and on my knees, and I fold my hands, and my daughter's looking at me kind of funny, and she kind of gets down on her knees. And the way she started her prayer changed the God of my understanding. She said, hi, God. It's me and my mom, and we'd like to hang out with you a little bit. And through that, through the voice of my daughter, I got it connected that I did deserve a gentle God. And what I know about this God now that I have in my life is still the hardest lesson that I have to learn. And that is that there's no limit to how happy God wants me to be. That's an incredible problem to have to learn in recovery, that there's no limit to how happy God wants me to be. That's pretty exciting news. So I needed this kind of God to take me into that dark cave of steps 4 and 5. Because I had been a pretty busy girl out there when I was single, and sometimes when I wasn't single. And I had I had done some pretty scary things. And what I know when I told those to my sponsor was, that's not who I am, or I'd still be doing them. I am a woman of dignity and grace. I am something worth restoration. That's the understanding that I have. We have that word restore. That's how I know who you are. Nothing gets restored unless it's something of worth and value. Think about it. An old antique piece of furniture, you don't take those harsh chemicals and those brushes and you don't scrub it up until it shines and becomes something of worth and value unless it was a treasure to start out with. And that's who we are in AA and Al-Anon. We are our treasures that are worth restoration. A great masterpiece sometimes has to be cleaned up with a tiny, tiny, tiny brush before it's restored. And sometimes our recovery has to be tiny, tiny increments. But nothing gets restored unless it started out as something of worth and value. And that's the understanding that I have of me today, and that's the understanding that I have of you, that we're worth restoring because we have value and worth. So that's what I got out of that steps 4 and 5. And I also got out that I had a lot of grieving to do because the disease is so greedy. It takes from us. And when something takes from you, you have losses. And when you have losses, you have to grieve the loss. And my biggest grieving had to be done around the loss of the dreams that I didn't live happily ever after with that first young man that I married. That my parents weren't always as available to me as they could have been because they were lost to the disease. That I wasn't present for my girls because I was lost to the disease. So when I experienced those losses, I had to cry and I had to grieve and I had to weep. And I had to know that I had to grieve the loss of the dreams. So what that did allowed me to have realistic dreams. The one day at a time dreams. I mean, I want to stay in today because I don't want to miss anything going on in my life now. This wonderful daughter, sober, married a young man, sober. He's sober 10 years. She's sober 15 years. And they're raising my grandsons. I brought this picture of them just because it is part of my story. You know, Al-Anon believes that alcoholism is a family illness. I also believe that recovery can be passed on. If we're going to pass on the disease, we can also pass on the recovery. And it's doing practicing these principles in all of our affairs. And I got these lessons because I see my daughter and her husband raising my grandsons, and they're present in their lives. Now, the twin boys are 4 years old, and the baby boy is a year and a half. So when I like to tell this because it still says about where I am as far as recovery goes. We have the three-year-old, three-year-old twins, and the baby's like 6 months old. And I've gone with my daughter to the wellness doctor's visit. And so we've had to wait out in the waiting room, and now we're in that tiny little room. And we've got 2 3-year-olds and a six-month baby, and every drawer and every cotton ball. And, I mean, these kids are like little monkeys all over this little room. And, you know, that paper, did you know how long that paper is? It goes on a long time when you pull on it. And so we're in here, and the moms, and we're trying to be spiritual, and, you know, here we are with these babies. Well, the pediatrician comes in, a wonderful young woman, and she knows about our family history because we share this. She knows that I'm in recovery, that my daughter's in recovery, and here's this wrecked room. And I said, you know, these twins, I said, we're saving them a chair. We're saving them an Al-Anon chair, and we're saving them an AA chair. And she says, whoa, whoa, whoa. She says, don't put any labels on these little guys. She said, it's not that three-year-olds act like alcoholics. It's that alcoholics act like three-year-olds. But I tell you, when you get a little three-year-old running through the house and the mom says, Parker, no running in the house. And he looks at her very funny and he says, Mama, I'm not running. I'm riding a buffalo. Just maybe, you know. I am so attracted to these little guys. Just maybe. I don't know. But the thing about it is that we're able to celebrate generations. My parents come and hang out with us. And my youngest daughter, who I got into Al-Anon and forced her into Alateen, and luckily she discovered boys and Alateen at about the same time, so she kept going to the meetings. And I really thought that she would transition from Alateen into Al-Anon, but she just didn't make it. She says, well, Mom, you hang around us and for any family gathering and a meeting's going to break out. And so we're so blessed that that's the way it is. And it came as a result of my working these steps. You know, it just didn't happen. It's like I had to be diligent. I had to work with a sponsor. I had to work these steps to the best of my ability. And some incredible things happened. For example, I learned how to care about you by doing step nine. You know, I had judged women all my life. In fact, I divided up the whole planet into two categories. If you were female, you were always after my man. And if you were a man, you were always after me. Now, that's just the way I divided the whole planet up until I got into working these steps. And what I realized, some incredible healing could happen as a result of working these steps. And there was a woman that showed up on my ninth step list. And I had talked about her in an early meeting. I had criticized her. She had talked about infidelity. And quite honestly, I wasn't ready to hear about it. And I couldn't find her. And I tell this story because I believe God wants us to do this work. I have a wonderful deck at my backyard, and it's my practice on nice days to take coffee and go out there with my book. And this morning I find myself on my front step looking out at the front street. And I have my ODAP book down there, and I'm looking down, and I'm going, God, I can't find this woman. I'd made amends with family members. I'd made amends with coworkers. I'd made amends with friends, but I couldn't find this woman because I'd criticized her so severely in early Al-Anon. And I look down, and I pick my head back up, and I look up, and this woman is walking down my street. Now, see, I didn't know her last name, so I couldn't find her. Nobody else remembered her like I remembered her, and I desperately try to find her, and I'm praying about it, and I look up, and she's walking down my street. I think she's a ghost that I've conjured up, you know. And here's what the video looks like. Here's this very attractive, well-dressed woman in her little jogging outfit going down my street. And here's this woman who's still in her nightgown, and I had really long hair at that time. And I jump up and I go running at her. It's you! It's you! And she backed up, and I said, look, I have been trying to find you. I've been needing to make amends because I was unkind. I said gossipy things about you. And she accepted my amends, but she was looking kind of strange. And see, when I made amends, my sponsor did not let me say too much more than three sentences, because she would say, you're not going to have to make amends on the way you made amends. Because I always thought that volume was the voice of reason. And if I could just get in front of them one more time and tell it a little bit louder, maybe they would catch on, you know. So I didn't have too much to say to this woman except what my sponsor had given me on a note card to say. But I noticed that she was looking kind of funny, and I said, what's going on with you? And she said, you know, I still go to Al-Anon. I live about three streets over. I walk about every morning, but I've never walked down this little street before. I was just trying to figure out where I am. So my belief is God wanted her to be there so I could make these amends to her. And when I was going through the steps again a couple of years later, I came across that step, and it seemed very confusing that it wasn't complete. And I just told you that incredible story of finding this woman, that God does help us do this work. And I believe that there was a list of people that I needed to make good amends to, that I needed to track down this teacher in high school and say, thank you. Thank you for getting me off the back row and getting me active in high school activities. I needed to find that woman that gave me those socks when I was so desperate that night, and I needed to say thank you. And so I made the list, and I tracked the people down with the same determination as I'd done my other amends list. And I just said, thank you. I did not tell you how important you were to me at that particular time in my life. So for what it's worth, I give you a chance to make some good amends. I loved it about, I hope you got to hear Wayne B. talk today. I love it about his busyness in his head. I really, really identify with that. In our area, we sometimes call it the committee going on in our head, or the gerbil going round and round. We have a friend that says his head is like a home entertainment center. It's got everything it needs but an off switch. So I really identify with all of that jamming of several stations at the same time in my head. And through working these steps, I was able to have an understanding as to what those voices were in my head. And in truth, they're the voices of my character defects. They're the voices of anger and procrastination and perfectionism and judgment. You know, and when they start chatting, now I can say, I hear you all, but you're going to have to line up so I can talk to you one at a time. And in our Courage to Change book, it says, being human is not a character defect. That's all I am. I'm just a human being. I am not a character defect. And so that's what helps me time and time again to touch these steps. I'd like to talk about some prayers and meditations and kind of do an ad for this workshop that my wonderful Now and Forever husband Scott are going to do tonight. You know, I got out of that second marriage through divorce, and I have balance in my life, and I'm lonely. And I had one daughter still at home. I had a cat, a dog, a goldfish, a rabbit, and a guinea pig. I thought, I'm lonely. I'm either going to have to start dating or buy a horse, you know. And on my knees, I said, God, I'm lonely. I didn't ask for anything, but I said, God, I'm lonely. And from that prayer, in 2 weeks, I realized that Scott, from his open AA meeting that I'd been attending for a long time, that he was going to be single. And part of that story is what you'll hear in our relationships talk. But I have to tell you that I say this prayer, God, I'm lonely, and then my girlfriend tells me that Scott's going to be single in a couple of weeks. And I said, I didn't even know he was having any trouble in his marriage. See, I was encouraged to go to open AA meetings almost from the get-go by my sponsor, never to talk, but to hear the stories of hope and to hear the stories of the disease of alcoholism, never to share in an AA meeting. It's not my meeting. I share in my AA, in my Al-Anon meeting. And when I believe that when other members come to Al-Anon meetings, they're there to share as Al-Anons and not AA, for what it's worth. See pamphlet, our pamphlet 45, if you've got any interest in that. But anyway, so I am thinking, I'm lonely, and now I find out Scott's going to be available in a couple of weeks. And it was like, I thought, she said he hadn't even lived in his household for almost 3 years. And I thought, that was information I wasn't supposed to have. So I've got this information, and I'm lonely, and I'd seen this guy. I thought he was very attractive. I loved what he had to say. Now I've got this information. I'm lonely. He's going to be single. I'm lonely. I'm going to be single. I guess I just kept obsessing on that. And one day I was leaving that AA meeting, and Scott stepped right in front of me, and he says, can I ask you something? And I said, well, yeah. He said, have I done something to offend you? And I said, no. Why do you ask that? And he said, well, you don't say hello. You don't say goodbye. You don't hug anybody at the meeting anymore. There's no eye contact. You don't go to lunch with us. And I just wondered if I'd done something to offend you. And see what had happened. I was taking that information. I'm lonely. He's going to be single. I'm lonely. He's going to be single. I'd taken that information and I obsessed on it so much that I changed my behavior trying to work out a plan again. And he said, have I done something to offend you? And I said, no. I found out you're going to be single and I'm interested. He said, oh, and stepped out of the way, and I bolted for my car. And it was before cell phones, and I had to wait till I got home to call my sponsor, and I called her, and I said, Scott said something to me today, and he said, blah, blah, and I said, I'm interested, and, oh, it's awful, what am I going to do? And she says, I think it'll be okay because you just told the truth, you know. So when Scott was single, he did ask me out, and in December we celebrated 10 years of living happily ever after, and that's the truth, yeah. Yeah. And part of our workshop is talking about how do we do a household with two recovery people in it. Well, what we do is we have an AA phone line coming into our house, and we have an Al-Anon phone line coming into our house. And we have an agreement that we do not work each other's program. It's not my business of how Scott works his program or how he sponsors his men. And it's not his business of how I work my program or how I sponsor the women that I sponsor. But we do have permission to give each other two questions if we see something going wrong. And the questions are this, and this is just a little teaser for our workshop. The two questions that we can ask each other at any given time, the first question is, How long has it been since you've been to a meeting? That's a good question, because our attitudes change with or without meetings. I think you know that. And the second question is, would you be willing to talk to your sponsor about that? That's a great question, because that means we both have sponsors, okay? So that's how we work our program. We have what I call a shared vision. In fact, this workshop could be called the shared vision. We're like the railroad track. We're two rails. And if you stand on a railroad track, it looks like the two rails touch out there, but it's an optical illusion. They never do. They never cross. They just have that shared vision. And our shared vision is that God is first, our program is second, and we're third in each other's lives. And sometimes we're not even that far up on the list, and we'll tell you some of those incidences in our workshop. So Scott and I met, we started courting, we started dating, and then we came time to go into the bedroom. Okay? Remember, I'm the woman that slept in the bathtub. I had used the bedroom inappropriately to reward, to punish, to manipulate. And now all of a sudden, this man that I absolutely love and adore, it's time for us to be two consenting adults. And I believe the physical exchange between a man and a woman is a celebration of love and caring. And I want it to be appropriate. I've had some counseling and professional help on some things that sometimes happen to young girls in alcoholic homes. I've had work around the steps. But sometimes when I'd head into that bedroom, some of those old ghosts would show up, no matter how much work. So I did what you've taught me to do. I went to God in a quiet time, and I said, God, I need a little help here. And I was given what I call my bedroom prayer. That's all. And I want to share it with you because I think it's so important that we talk about bedroom experiences, that's part of sharing our recovery. So before Scott and I are going to have a physical exchange, I simply say this prayer. God, help me stay in the moment. That's all. That's the prayer. God, help me stay in the moment. And what that does, it eliminates some of those thoughts that I have that from my past. And it also eliminates my curiosity about Scott's past. Quite honestly, he was a bad boy out there for a long time. No, he wasn't, he says. Okay. And it eliminates that thought in the morning, is he going to notice that I've gained weight? Or was it really okay? Those silly thoughts that we sometimes have. And so what I know, if I pray that prayer, God, help me stay in the moment, that Mother Nature takes care of the rest of it, and that's it. That's the prayer. Oh, okay. Thank you. Oh, I don't want to lose our PG-13, but more will be revealed in the workshop. How's that? Okay. So some of the easier prayers are, God, help me be today the kind of person my dog thinks I am. That's a good prayer. I love the prayer of, God, help me be today the kind of person you think I am. And the other Al-Anon prayer that helps me so much is, God, please keep your arm around my shoulders and your hand over my mouth. That's a wonderful Al-Anon prayer. I'd like to share some more about meditation really fast. I never had time to do meditation, so I had to come up with a meditation that had a handle on it. And that's that every time I didn't have time for meditation, that's when God would put me in the longest line at the grocery store or put me in all the traffic. And so I realized that I could have the God of my understanding meditation any place I wanted it to be. So when you're in the line, this is a true story. I'm standing in line at the grocery store. I haven't done meditation that morning. And the woman in front of me, I'm in the 10 items or less line. I've bought one carton of milk. She has 22 items in her basket. I've counted them. I'm thinking, I don't have time for this. I'm a busy woman. And I'm only going to get 1 gallon of milk. And now the woman's trying to write an out-of-town check. And that little pink thing has come up on the cash register. I mean, I'm going to be here forever. And I remember I didn't have time for meditation, so I go back to one of my times that God made enough time. And God's given me the gift of this time. And the meditation is, in a quiet time, you visualize something over your head. It can be a cardboard box or a terracotta clay pot. It can be a crystal bowl. And you put in all the good things in it. This shared laughter this weekend, a hug from your sponsor, the smell of a puppy, all that good stuff. And now you're standing in line and you really don't have time for this. But you remember that you do have time now for a meditation. And all of this wonderful stuff is now golden goo. And you tip it over and it just melts down you like wax going down the side of a candle. And I'm renewed. And I've had a touch with God. I've had a spiritual connect. And now I'm able to practice these principles in all my affairs because I can tell this woman, I can tell your visitor in Nashville, Tennessee, I hope you have a safe and wonderful trip. And to me, that's part of extending the pebble in the pond as far as Al-Anon is concerned. She doesn't have to know my last name. She doesn't even have to know I'm an Al-Anon. She just has to know that I'm another human being walking on the planet. I want to say thank you for coming and hanging out with me. My spiritual awakening is that I have choices. I never knew I had choices before I came into Al-Anon. I have a choice to say yes. I have a choice to say no. I have a choice to go to a meeting or not go to a meeting. I have a choice to call my sponsor or not call my sponsor. I'm so glad that you decided to say yes and come and hang out with me this afternoon. I said yes when Bill called me several months ago. God bless you, and we'll see you at 10 o'clock tonight. Thanks.